नमो तस्स भगवतो अरहतो सम्मा सम्बुद्धस्स नमो तस्स भगवतो अरहतो सम्मा सम्बुद्धस्स नमो तस्स भगवतो अरहतो सम्मा सम्बुद्धस्स बुद्धं धम्मं संघं नमस्सामि So this is a special occasion, Visakha Puja, and we're very fortunate to have Rumpa Liam here, the head monk of Wat Pa Nong Pa Pong in Thailand. And of course, this monastery was established with the teachings of Lungpo Cha, our teacher who passed away 25 years ago, but the teaching is one that is timeless. It's not about an individual personality or monk or it doesn't depend upon a particular person. And as Lungpa Liam was saying, the Buddha, the Putto, is something with us here and now. It's not, even though we think back to the historical Buddha in India 2,557 years ago, that is part of a tradition, established a tradition that has been able to survive up to this present moment. And that's the power when the Buddha, the historical Buddha, established the Dhamma and the Vinaya. And before he let go of his sankharas, and this was Dhamma is the truth of the way it is, it's reality. So the teachings of the Buddha are always pointing at reality. And not pointing at just the particular aspects of reality like the best or the highest point, but to the reality of the way things are. And of course the way things are is that all conditions, we're living in this realm of conditions, of phenomena, of incessant change. And we tend to not really notice this change. We tend to want it to be something. We want happiness to be permanent. We want to feel secure, a kind of permanent sense of security within the changing conditions of our own body, our own emotions, mental states. And so when we talk about Dhamma, we're not talking about some kind of metaphysical ideal, but about the reality of here and now. If we awaken, wake up and observe, this is our ability as a human individual to observe change rather than try to change into something we want. This is the Visakha Puja day, so it's the celebration of the birth, enlightenment, and death, the rising and the ultimate and the passing away of conditioned phenomena. And so it's always a very important time to reflect that right here and now as we sit here in this temple, you know, we've already been born, and so that is, we can just take for granted. Because our physical forms are sitting here and now. And then we all know in the future we're going to die. That's the nature of conditioned phenomena. What is born dies. And between those two points is, of course, the enlightenment, being able to awaken to the conditions we find ourselves with in the present. You know, it's not about me trying to become enlightened after I was born, but awakening to the reality of Dhamma in the present. And that's always here and now. It's not about the future or past lives. People like to, speculate about past lives or what the future will bring. But the reality that we're facing is here and now. It's not about something that might happen in the future or something that happened in the past. And of course, the human bodies that we have are time conditions. They're phenomenon that was born. And now, of course, everybody's aware that Ajahn Sumedho's in a conventional way is going to be 80 years old. And of course that's contemplating the age of 80 from the conventional sense, from personality, from a sense of identity with a body, from cultural conditioning, from the ego. Then one tends to see somebody 80 years old is really old. But at this moment, I don't feel old. I look old, but... So the age is part of a convention that we all are aware of. We have certain views we form when we're young about, being 15. I remember when I was 9 years old, I wanted to be 10 years old. I wanted a two-digit age. And when up to 9, you're only stuck with one digit. And the desire to be 10 years old, and it seemed to be waiting, it took me a long time to reach 10. But now it's 80. And it doesn't seem like it's been very long, actually, looking back. It doesn't seem all that long ago. I was just 9 years old. But these are ways of thinking, of perceiving. Our own cultural conditioning affects how we interpret our experience. Our identity with the body is one of the basic problems we have, because from the time we're born, where our parents, our mother, our father, our society inform us that we are this body, and it's a boy or girl, or it's little or whatever, it's beautiful or not beautiful, but the whole sense of a self evolves from these identities, these conventional perceptions that we acquire when we're innocent babies, when we're little children, and we don't have the wisdom to see through it. We just absorb whatever is given to us, the thoughts, the feelings, the values, the emotions of our parents and our social community. And of course, you can see here now at this meeting today, we all come from different social backgrounds, cultural backgrounds. We have different ages, men and women, and so forth. These are all the differences in terms of the conditioned realm that we're experiencing. But the common ground that we share is consciousness. Where, consciousness isn't culturally programmed. It's not something that we acquire through what our parents tell us or our cultural perceptions are. When a baby is born, it's born as a conscious form, as a conscious human form. And so consciousness is natural phenomena. It's that which is our ability to pay attention, to be aware and awake. And then the conditions we're in are, changing according to other conditions. So we, like the body itself has its span of life, and when the time comes, then it dies. And death is just the end of what was born. Enlightenment then, in the sense of Visakha Puja, is our ability to awaken to reality, to know Dhamma in a direct way, not know all about Dhamma. Sometimes we know about Dhamma, we read the scriptures, or we have various views and opinions about it, but the emphasis is on awakenness. Sati Sampajanya means our ability, everyone's ability, to pay attention to this present moment as it is, because ultimately that's all we have, that's all we can ever know, is the present moment. The past is what we remember, so we remember yesterday, or 10 years ago, we can recall, but then that always is arising in the present. When you're 80 years old, you can remember a lot of things. They're busy writing my biography in Thailand, and they're always calling on me to remember things that I don't particularly want to remember, actually. But some of the monks where I live have interviewed me and ask about all kinds of things, and then it stirs up memory. But it's always memory arising in the present, arising, ceasing, rather than Ajahn Sumedho in the past or whatever. You know, it's not to create a sense of a personal identity with memory, but to reflect on memory as that which arises in the present and ceases. And then I won't actually be 80, fully 80, until July. And so now when people ask me what my age is, I say, nearly 80. And then in July I'll be able to say, I'm completely 80. And join the Octogenarian Club with Joan. And so this is a elite club of people who've managed to survive this long. This is it's the way of reflecting, because the Buddha, the teaching he provided us with, I've followed diligently for many years. I became interested when I was about 21 in Zen Buddhism, when I was in the American Navy, and that stuck a note of interest, like the approach was so totally different than anything I experienced in my own background, social background, religious background. And from that time on, this has been my main interest, is the Buddha Dhamma. And then coming to Thailand in 1966, I was fortunate enough to meet Lungpa Cha, because I came to Thailand with the intention, deliberate intention, of trying to find somebody who could show me how to practice it. And by the time I reached Thailand, I'd already read innumerable books and literature on Tibetan Buddhism, Zen Buddhism, anything I could find on Buddhism or Hinduism or Vedanta or any kind of Eastern approach was something I was very eager to read. Well, you can read so much, and then felt that okay, I know enough on that level, but I'm still, you know, it inspired me, it increased faith, but it didn't really change me. I still managed to create endless problems in my mind. And I realized that the way the Buddha actually emphasized patibhata, or practice. And so this in the traditional Pali style, Pali teaching, there's the Bariyatti Dhamma, which is the study of the scripture. So that's like the Four Noble Truths as we learned it in the suttas. And then the patibhata is the actual practice, making it work, not just intellectually knowing the terms, the terminologies, and that's one level of knowing. But patibhata is like insight knowledge, where you make it work, then you know what it is like. Like Bariyatti Dhamma is like, somebody describes honey, and you read all about honey, it's sweet, delicious, and people say it's wonderful, good for you, healthy, and you've read everything you know you can find on honey, but you still don't quite know what it tastes like. And then you actually taste it, and that's Batibata. It's actually tasting the Dhamma yourself. And even though other people can tell you honey's sweet, you don't really know what the flavor is till you taste it yourself. And of course, this was what Lungpa Cha emphasized. When I first met him, I couldn't understand the language. I had no knowledge of Thai or the Isan dialect, and so I had, I did pick up words, and one of the words I kept hearing was Batibat. And there's a Thai word for Batibata, or the practice. In the Four Noble Truths, of course, these noble truths, there's three aspects to each one. So the first one is the Bharati practice, receiving the knowledge from the scripture, the traditional scripture, the Tripitaka, and then the Bodhibhata practicing. There is dukkha, and dukkha should be understood. And so how do you understand dukkha? You know, how do you understand suffering? If you just read about it, you know, I was very much aware of suffering, my own suffering, but the suffering was always interpreted in personal terms. And so much like my own cultural background is a incessant search for happiness. You know, we're brought up to always look for happiness in life. We want security, happiness. We want to be young and healthy. We want to be successful. We want all the best. And so then when we suffer because we don't get what we want, then we tend to see it as there's something wrong, either with oneself or with the world around us. And it's very interesting living in England for so many years where you have interfaith meetings with other religions, and they talk about love all the time and God, and this is inspiring. These words are inspiring. Suffering is not inspiring, is it? And so when you're faced with an interfaith dialogue, you know, and you talk about suffering, why don't you talk about love or, you know, the very high metaphysical perceptions of ultimate reality. And this, of course, one begins to realize the wisdom behind this particular approach of the Buddha, taking something nobody wants and putting it in our minds as a noble truth. None of us want suffering. We want love, security. We'd like to know the deity, the God, the creator. We'd like to be sure that there's heaven and everything will be all right in the future. We have great desires for these hopes and wishes about the future. And yet, dukkha is very much, or suffering, the Pali word dukkha, is translated in so many different English terms. I just use suffering just to get by because, you know, there's other terms that are allowed, but it just means there's a dissatisfaction, unhappiness, worry, anxiety, discontentment. It doesn't necessarily need to be intense or, you know, like being crucified or tortured by somebody. It just means right now just wanting something you don't have or not wanting things to be the way they are. And this, on Visakha Puja Day, where you're celebrating the birth, enlightenment, death, then, of course, this emphasizes this pattern, all that is born ceases. What is born dies. What begins ends. And, of course, before we die, before we physically die, we have an opportunity to observe arising and ceasing. We don't have to wait till our body dies. Don't wait that long. It might be too late. But in the present moment, to be aware of the nature of sankhara or conditioned phenomena. So this Pali word sankhara is a collective. It includes everything that the physical body, the emotional habits, the thoughts, the memories. It includes the sun and moon, the stars, the universe, that which is far away and strange and mystical, to just the ordinariness of the present moment, to the unknown possibilities or conditions that we're experiencing through our bodies and minds in this present time. So keeping in mind that the nature of all phenomena is impermanent, sape sankharani cha, is a constant refrain when you're practicing meditation. Vipassana meditation is looking into change, observing change. And of course, we can easily understand the concept, all conditions are impermanent. That's no great achievement. But to actually pay attention to change in the present, that's the bhatibhatta, the practice. Because one thing, you know, the present moment is all there ever is when you really reflect on the past or the future. All experience is here and now. So we experience pleasure, pain, boredom, happiness, sorrow, grief, success and failure, and so forth, always in the present moment. You can anticipate failure in the future, but you're actually creating the conditions in the present, worrying about not succeeding or things going wrong in the future. You can spend your time regretting things you've done in the past. A problem with many of us is feeling guilty. We have guilt problems about, we remember we've said or done things that weren't very good or even might be very bad in the past, and then we feel guilty. But in the present moment, these emotions, these feelings are what they are in the present. Then if you remind yourself to observe change, then you can see the nature of conditioned phenomena, and that applies from everything from the microscopic level to the macrocosmic universe. And that's a kind of miraculous ability we have as a human individual to awaken to change. And this is so simple, so here and now, so basic, that most people find it incredibly difficult, because we're programmed to believe in delusions of our cultural background, our society. We're programmed from infancy to believe we are the bodies that we're inhabiting. We believe in all the biases, prejudices, cultural attitudes, religious biases. We believe our own emotions are really my problem. Guilt is my problem. Anger is my problem. Lust and doubt and worry is my problem. We can spend a lifetime seeking different therapies to resolve all these different problems that we are attached to and identify with. But in the simplicity of the Four Noble Truths, the pointing in the direction, the advice is to awaken to them, to investigate them. And so this is like suffering is the most common experience we all share. Whether you're rich or poor, male or female, whatever age, race, nationality, ethnic identity, there's something we all share is that we suffer. So this is not about culture. It's not about Indian ancient Indian culture. It's about the common bond that all human beings share as humanity. And so this, when we recognize this, we feel compassion, we feel a sense of oneness with all human beings, with all beings in fact, because we can see the animal kingdom suffers, that suffering is the nature of this realm. And this realm is about birth and death. What we experience through these forms is all about happiness, suffering, wanting to survive, wanting to be loved, not wanting to be rejected, wanting to be approved of, fear of being despised, punished. And we're brought up in a society that conditions us through reward and punishment. So we learn very quickly if we're good little boys, we get rewarded, and if we're bad, we get punished. And so that's the society we're in, is our mental states, emotional habits are conditioned through identity with the physical body and the incessant rewards, the punishments and that we experience as we grow up. And then we create ourselves into a personality, into a kind of fixed idea or view of oneself as this type, this kind, this particular character. And everyone's doing this, so it's reinforced in society, in societies everywhere. And so this is why the Buddha chose dukkha as the first noble truth rather than love, because love is not to deny love, but if we're not very much aware of that, we don't understand it. We tend to feel our sense of love is always through attachment to conditions, to another person, to something or other. We tend to experience love through attachment to conditioned phenomena, and inevitably it leads to grief and sorrow, because there is no condition that can be permanently dependable and permanently loving. And so the dukkha then is the common ground we share. And this is a noble truth. It's not, it's not an ultimate truth. And no, there's a difference. There's an ultimate truth, and then there's a noble truth. So this is a conventional, this is a convention to use. It's a pointer. And the Buddha's teachings are pointing. They're not dogmatic perceptions that we grasp and operate from grasping dukkha, but understanding it. So dukkha should be understood. Good. And then the third aspect is the insight. Dukkha has been understood. And this is an intuitive function where we actually recognize, we know ourselves. It's no longer just, I understand the word and what the definition of suffering is, but it's knowing in a very direct, insightful way through practice. So there's these three. My voice isn't very good. So these three aspects apply to all the other three noble truths. Notice the structure is a reflective one. You know, you've got the statement, what to do about it, and the result. And so this is not dogmatic attachment to a Buddhist doctrine or a Buddhist idea. It's actually a pointing, making you wake up, look at suffering, understand it, and then you'll know what it is. You're no longer just blaming it on others or try to find happiness. You can actually use suffering as a way of practice. It's the key to enlightenment. And then the other three are the cause of suffering is the attachment to desires. Now consider this realm is a desire realm. We're living in a desire form. The human body is about desire. It's about procreating the species. It's about hunger and thirst. It's about survival. And this realm that we're experiencing is a realm of desire. So the Buddha is not to get rid of desire. You know, we're not trying to destroy desire, but to understand it, to look at desire in a way that we're not just, trying to dismiss it or seeing it in terms of maybe some cultural perception or moral value. But the second noble truth is about dhanha and the three kinds of desire for sense pleasure, for becoming, for getting rid of things. So you can see in your own mind, you know, the desire for sensual pleasure, to have delicious food, beautiful things to see, sounds to the ear, fragrance to the nostrils, tasty food, and pleasurable sensations on the body. So the gamadana is easy to see. You can be aware of gamadana. And that awareness then, the sati sampatthanya, is not a desire. It's not a condition that's created out of ignorance. It's the ability, that this wonderful ability we all have to awaken, to observe dukkha dana, and then to understand it, to recognize sensual desire, wanting pleasure through the senses, not wanting unpleasant sensual experiences. We don't want physical pain. We don't want to look at ugly sights or bad odors or terrible food. You know, we want to get rid of that. We want the good side of it. But we are aware of it, aren't we? We can be aware that we don't like something or want something we don't have. In the religious life, the holy life that we're living, is desire for becoming is one of the problems we all face. We want to become arahants or stream emperors. We want to attain. We read the scriptures. And the general way people talk is about attaining arahantship. You know, this creates a desire to become an arahant. And in order to become an arahant, we have to get rid of our desires. And this is the kind of logic that we create in the mind. But aware of this, of wanting to become, attain, and achieve, is something you can observe. You know, I've spent a lot of time observing my bhava-dhanha desires, you know, desire to get, to achieve, to become, and also the vipava-dhanha, desire to get rid of kilesa, get rid of anger, get rid of lust, get rid of worry and doubt, get rid of guilt. So then this is how I'm culturally conditioned, is to identify with these emotions, these principles, these ideals, wanting to be good, not wanting to be bad, and so forth. You know, this is part of the conditioning process. But the awakened consciousness is aware of dhanha. It's not a criticism. It's a sense of recognizing dhanha is like this: wanting, wishing, hoping, either for sense pleasure, for becoming something, that you think you're not, you say, I'm not an arahant, I want to become one, is a creation of the mind in the present. And, you know, because we tend to conceive ourselves as unenlightened people with a lot of defilements. And this is another creation of the mind, isn't it? We create this sense of oneself as being somebody with kilesas, with faults, with problems, emotional problems, and then we identify with that. And then we want to get rid of them and become somebody that we think, like an arahant, doesn't have any more problems, and be completely pure and peaceful, we hope and wish. And where the second noble truth is awakening to this, these desires, it's and then the insight, the buddhi-buddha, is to let go, isn't it? To ploy wang, to let go of desire. And letting go is not a desire to get rid of, it's just letting things be what they are. Sankharas are like this. Happiness is like this. Unhappiness is like this. And we're not, when we practice letting go, we recognize that trying to get rid of unhappiness is the problem. We can bear unhappiness. If we're patient, we can endure. And actually allowing unhappiness to cease, because it's a sankhara performing its duty, and it will cease if we allow it to, and don't try to reject it, nor despise it, or create any more problems around it. So this is our gift of humanity. This, like Lumpa Liam was saying, it's the human species, you know, has this ability to pay attention to the reality of here and now. We're not just helpless victims of circumstances or of fate. At any moment, we can pay attention to what we're feeling physically or mentally, emotionally. And in that awakened state, that satisampajanya, that's not personal. It's not like you can't claim it on a personal way, but you can be that knowing of this simple teaching, all conditions that arise must cease. So in the Nirodha, or the end of suffering, or the death of conditioned phenomena, we observe it in our mind. You know, you don't have to, you know, it's not about going looking at, outward at people dying, but observing just in your own experience here and now of the presence, and be patient, allowing the condition of the present to be what it is, and you'll have the insight into its cessation. So there's nothing you have to do, but just patiently sustain awareness, recognition of the present, whatever emotion you happen to be experiencing here now. Accept it, let it be what it is, and then you'll be aware of its absence. And then you have the insight into Nirodha, or the end of suffering. So this is to be proven in your own mind, in your own conscious experience. It's not that difficult, but it does mean we have to change from the identity, the personal identity, the ego, the sakya ditti, the sense identity with the body and with the conditions we're experiencing. It's not operating from that position anymore of I am this body, this personality, these emotions, these feelings, memories, everything are mine, to observing, being the putto, or the knower of conditioned phenomena. And so in the Thai forest tradition, they emphasize this putto, which is the Buddha's name. And so it's like a mantra, can be used as just something to, if you're going to think, like Lumpa Cha told me in the early days, he said, you know, you're an obsessed thinker, you think too much, so just think puto, which made sense. I couldn't stop thinking. You know, I tried to stop thinking, and then I couldn't really sustain that, but I could, if I was going to think, then deliberately think puto, puto. And that seemed to help a lot. Because it was approaching the problem an obsessive thinking problem that I had. And so then it also has a deeper, profound value in the fact that it's awakened consciousness. It's not about believing in Buddha, but it's a reminder of pay attention here and now, awake to reality. So I've defined, when they talk about Dhamma, I say, what is the practice? I say it's awakening to reality. Dhamma is reality. And then the puto is awakening to Dhamma, puto, tamo. And then sankho is one who practices this awakening, who develops, cultivates awakeness in one's daily life. And this is opportunity we have specifically in the monastic forms that we have, Buddhist monasticism, in fact, that it's a condition, it's a form for, that helps us to awaken to the continuity that we're experiencing in the present, because we're living in a community of different personalities, different types, different expectations, and so forth. So we can emphasize, we can make problems endlessly around living with these people, these monks, these nuns, and so forth. We tend to see reality as always somebody else's. My happiness wouldn't be complete if somebody else wasn't here. And that won't work. But it's through awakening to we're actually supatipanno, ujjapatipanno, one who practices in the right way, one who practices it directly. And this is bhavana in the sense of really developing this mindfulness that integrates into the daily life that we all have to live till the body decides it's finished and dies off. But this teaching is a very appropriate teaching for the present time, because modern society is one that is totally confused. You know, you look around you, whether you're in England or Thailand or America or wherever, nobody knows what they're doing anyway. You know, so they're always talking about peace and resolution, but nobody understands peace, and they don't know how to resolve anything within their own minds. So it goes around in circles. Is that somebody getting bored? I'll stop in a few minutes. But peace is the idea of peace is very appealing, but mainly people don't really want peace. They want romance, adventure, and excitement. And none of those are peaceful. And that's the thing you learn in monastic life. It's boring. And no romance. You do have adventures. And we get excited about all kinds of things. But the point is this form is not a personal form. It's not about becoming anything, but it's a form to remind us to develop this mindfulness. So it's the way we actually live our lives mindfully. And this is within our potential, over the many years I've had this opportunity to live in this form. Now I feel incredibly grateful to the Buddha and to Lumbhacha and the Sangha, because it's allowed me to develop and cultivate this way, this practice of awareness, and integrate it into a daily life that I have to live wherever, whether I'm here, Amravati, or in Thailand. It doesn't make much difference about the time or the place, because it's always about here and now. So on this special occasion, I'm quite overwhelmed to be back in England again, and I had a very peaceful life in Thailand. I'm incredibly grateful to Ajahn Emeril for taking on the duties, freed me from all the responsibilities of this place, and because I never expected it to happen. I thought I'd have to be responsible for everything till I dropped dead. Anyway, Ajahn Emeril is, I don't know how he feels, but man, it's Thailand is a very nice country to live in when you're an old monk. They just love old monks there. So I offer this as a reflection for this day.
Andamayang Vadagata Sadukarang Dadamase Sadhu 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 Ah.